Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
And good evening, and welcome to History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please call toll-free at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me and tell me your views. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. Tonight's show was brought to you by the folks at Avcom, where traveling safe always matters and where safe travel is a top priority and guaranteed. Tonight's topic, District of Columbia for statehood. The D.C. area needs statehood, and I think this is an interesting topic for all of us to listen to. Holding public office is a tremendous responsibility and a real gutsy thing to do. It can either be a power grab or an opportunity to do something good. And it's not about being a Democrat. It's not about being a Republican. It's not about being liberal or conservative either. It's about helping people get a better chance at gaining an equal standard of opportunity under our system of laws. But our system of laws can also make it so that doing a public good, quote unquote, can be a difficult thing to do. If you take a liberal approach to it, then the sweeping changes are too swift for folks to absorb. A conservative approach, on the other hand, could make managing a less innovative status quo a stodgier and less fluid environment for changes to grow. Either way, anybody running for public office has to know that his or her efforts at finding improvement through advancement is rarely going to reach people in vast numbers consistently. But apparently, my guest this evening has found a way to do that for the folks he represents. Without being spared any bumps along the road, tonight's guest fights for equal rights for statehood for American citizens currently living in the District of Columbia. Elected in 2006 with 84% of the vote, that's 84% of the vote, talk about a mandate here. He has served the people in the D.C. area with distinction by traveling across America, speaking on issues that can benefit and better represent his district. As an active member of the Democratic Party, he was a superdelegate at the 2008 and again in the 2012 Democratic conventions for President Obama, and has campaigned for the president in Pennsylvania and Missouri. In 2009, my guest established a nationwide nonprofit organization called Teach Democracy DC, designed to engage teachers and students across America to get them involved in the DC struggle for statehood. Forever busy, this gentleman was reelected once again back in November with a whopping majority of 80% of the vote. Talk about a mandate again for a second time. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I introduce this evening's guest, Senator Michael D. Brown, Shadow Senator from the District of Columbia. Senator, welcome to the show, History and You.
Thank you so much, George. I so much appreciate you having me. And I also appreciate your introduction. It was very kind and gracious. And the comment that you made about it's not about being a Republican or being a Democrat is so true. And it really strikes true with this issue, because Republicans and Democrats polled nationwide pretty much agree that we should have the same rights in the District of Columbia everybody else has.
That's right. And you know, it's all about helping people. It's all about trying to do that public good, trying to identify that public good, going out and doing it, and so many people miss the mark. And in particular, Senator, I have to tell you that targeting the D.C. area, these are folks that I get the impression, without really knowing the issue as well as I should, it strikes me that these are people that are easily forgotten, and they should not be.
Well, and therein lies our problem. Everybody should understand this problem better than they do, because we really don't get the message out there enough. 80% of the American people believe that we have the same representation that everybody else has, because why wouldn't you believe that? It's
exactly.
Counterintuitive to think that we don't in the District of Columbia. So that's an important thing to get out there. And yes, we are. We're easily forgotten because we're a small constituency. Even though we're 632,000 loyal American citizens, we are small in reference to other constituencies that have had to fight for their civil rights.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, when you had African Americans fighting in the South for their civil rights, or women, they had constituents all over the country. Unfortunately, all our constituents live in a square that's a little less than 10 miles.
Yeah, exactly.
In the District of Columbia.
Exactly. And you know, I know you've been involved in many other endeavors aside from my rather limited introduction of your long political career, Senator, but with just over 600,000 residents in the D.C. area, you're known to be a shadow senator. Could you please tell us exactly what that is?
Well, actually, this idea started, it's a very old office, and it started in 1796 in Tennessee. When Tennessee wanted to become a state, they elected two United States senators, sent them to Washington, D.C. They lobbied for statehood. Tennessee ultimately became a state, and then other states, Michigan, California, Minnesota, Oregon, Alaska, used the same method to become states. It's called the Tennessee Plan. So in the 1980s, when the district decided it wanted to become a state, they decided to use the Tennessee Plan as well. And in the early 90s, actually 1990, the first two United States senators from the District of Columbia were elected. And our official title is United States Senator, but we're called shadow senators because we're not recognized by the Senate. We have no voting power. We actually are not. Our job is to lobby for statehood, basically.
Right. So actually, your job is really the more of a personal effort, more of an expression that perhaps you genuinely really do want to get out there and work it for those people that you represent, because you don't have voting power.
That's right. And you know what? That is both the upside and the downside of the job. The downside is it's very frustrating because I don't have power. But the upside is that I do get to do a lot of wonderful things, which is to, in general, talk to the public and try to persuade them. I get to give speeches, and as my wife says, my gift in life is shaking hands and kissing babies, and you know, I get to do a lot of that kind of campaign stuff, and that's where I've always been. I've always been a campaigner, so and it's a good cause. So I really enjoy what I do. Unfortunately, I wish we were making a little more progress.
Right. What's the reason? Can you think of perhaps another reason why the D.C. area has been so easy to forget, which I think is directly related to statehood? But and I know that by default it's an area that people forget. But why? Is it something with the kind of constituency that has occupied the D.C. area for decades or much longer than that? Or is it a locational issue? Or is it anything else that perhaps you haven't yet brought up?
Well, I think it's that's a very good question, and I think it's very complex. I think, first of all, we have the 80% problem, you know, the problem I talked about earlier with the poll, where 80% of the people in America think we are exactly the same as everybody else. So they don't understand the situation we find ourselves in. Politically, we have another problem, and that is that we're the most democratic, and by democratic I mean Democratic Party, jurisdiction in America. We have no elected Republicans on our city council. We've never elected a Republican mayor. We've never once voted for a Republican for president. So we have this partisan problem, which exists on Capitol Hill, that it's assumed that if the district becomes a state and we get two senators and a voting representative, that they will be Democrats in perpetuity. And then Thirdly, I think we just have a general PR problem where people around the country think that Washington, D.C. really has no inhabitants. We just have people that work for the IRS.
Yeah.
And that's not true. We actually have 630 loyal citizens, doctors, lawyers, school teachers, everybody that's exactly like you. And so I think those problems together make the district easy to ignore.
You know, that's really a shame. That may, because the whole district, the whole political aura of the District of Columbia, the very seat of our national capital has been strapped and caught within the web of a stereotype, it seems to me, based on what you're saying. And that's really a shame because these people really do, I would think, deserve the kind of attention, legal attention, through statehood that they so very much deserve. Senator, I wanted to ask you something else. Which is a little bit different, a different twist to where I want to take this conversation with you. Can you, as a shadow senator, filibuster, or in any way participate in one? And what I mean by participating in one is there any way that perhaps you can associate yourself to a team of senators that is participating or that all are participating currently in a particular filibuster for a particular cause?
Well, we have no right to filibuster. We have no rights at all in the Senate. We have no floor privileges. Any right that we get is extended as a courtesy to us. And we do get a few minor rights, you know, where we can submit testimony and do other things. But they're completely... that's completely a courtesy, given the fact that, in the last election I got 207,000 votes. So there's some people that appreciate that and extend certain courtesies to us, but we have no official capacity whatsoever in the United States Congress. So the answer to your question is no, officially I can't do that. Are there some senators that might allow me to do it as part of a group? Perhaps, but it really has no particular meaning for us because we're outside of Congress, really. We're
right.
Lobbyists.
Right. Well, yeah, I was just thinking about recently that 13-hour rant by Rand Paul, and I was wondering if in some way you were able to participate in that or go against it, rather.
No, we really can't. And you know, that's a powerful tool that a senator has.
Very, very, very. Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
Unfortunately,
and
we don't have that.
Yeah, no, and a lot of people really don't understand, I mean, the whole strategy behind the filibuster, which I spoke about in my last show regarding Rand Paul's filibuster. I mean, any rumor of that in the Senate just seems to strike terror in the hearts of the rest of the senators because it holds up the Senate business so much and it just paralyzes everything that needs to get done there.
Oh, yeah, and these guys are boring enough on their own. When you give them a purpose to be boring, it's even tougher.
Yeah, I'm sure. Senator, what might be some other issues that affect the D.C. area residents at the federal level?
We have a lot, and our problem all stems from a clause in the Constitution which gives Congress the exclusive right in all cases to create legislation in the District of Columbia. So let me give you just a couple of typical problems.
Yeah.
One problem is that the Congress and the President of the United States signed two budgets. They signed the District of Columbia budget and they signed the federal budget. What this means to the District of Columbia is that very often our budget is held up till October or November to be approved. Well, of course, if you look at something like schools, our school system starts in September, like everybody else, or in late August. So we have to spend money for a couple of months that we don't even have officially. So that really...
Now, this money that you're talking about, you are not necessarily delegated or specifically allowed to handle this money?
We are. But Congress has the right to approve our budget, and they do approve our budget. So what happens is when Congress wants to control the District of Columbia, more often than not, they do it through the budget. And
now,
to give you an example, we passed a needle exchange program to help with HIV, the spread of HIV in the district, but Congress took the money for the HIV needle exchange program out of our budget for 10 consecutive years, so we could never implement it.
So that goes directly to what I was asking, because then Congress authorizes the amount of money for these programs that the D.C. residents need, but as far as the power to allocate how much money will go into how many different kinds of programs, Congress has that power as well?
They have the power to approve it. The way I generally explain it is we're like the national teenager, you know. We have the credit card, and it's got a $100 limit, and when we want to use it, we have to call home and see if it's okay. That's kind of how it works in the district. We can approve I need to make it clear that this is all our money. This isn't federal money. This is locally collected tax money, property taxes and sales tax and every kind of tax we have.
So you collect all that money, but you have to get congressional approval for it?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes. And then they constantly, on a regular basis, they put riders on our budget, which allows them to do everything from the federal government has created a charter school system in the District of Columbia. They've last year I was arrested and went to trial in a protest where
I did some research on that, and I was going to ask you about that as well.
Yes, we got approximately 75 of us got arrested over a 2-week period, including the mayor and several members of the city council, because the president said that he would negotiate away the right of the District of Columbia to provide funding for certain types of abortions for poor women if Congress would make some concessions on the budget. And we all got very mad about that. So we went out in the street and we said, no, you know, we're not going to let this happen.
Wow. So it's a total deprivation of autonomy then for the D.C. area.
Yeah. We actually have a piece of legislation on the special election ballot on April 23rd. There's a ballot initiative on the 23rd of April to give us autonomy finally over our own budget. But even if the voters pass that, it will have to go and lay over in Congress for 35 working days, and Congress can reject it. So we can pass it, and Congress can say, no way, and then it doesn't become law.
Senator, this is very interesting because this is really opening up a whole series of doors that I am very, very sure the vast majority of people out there are not clearly aware of. But let me turn this situation on its head just a little bit and ask you a question from an opposite perspective now. Are there any dangers in allowing the District of Columbia the kind of autonomy that you are so vigorously lobbying for? In other words, does it pose a dangerous precedent of perhaps letting the Congress dilute and diffuse its authority to control, its power to control too much? Will it, for example, inspire the state of Texas to move further along for its own sense of independence? And will it encourage Oregon to do similar in breaking away from the union? Does granting the D.C. area the autonomy you are looking for, does it pose a danger for the further dilution of congressional power?
Well, I mean, certainly I think in the very abstract, you could make that argument. But basically, and in a very real sense, yes, if you expand the members of the House of Representatives from 435 members to 436, you have diluted their power, I guess. And if you expand the United States Senate from 100 members to 102 members, then yes, you have diluted their power a little bit, I guess. But the right to bestow statehood on American citizens is a right that Congress has had since the Constitution was written. So it's well within their purview to do this. And does it set a bad precedent? No, I don't think it does, because the citizens of the District of Columbia have been loyal citizens for more than 200 years. We have over 30 Congressional Medal of Honor winners. We fought in every war, and we pay the highest per capita income taxes in America, federal income taxes. You know, the other territories, if you want to look at us like a territory or federal enclave, do not pay federal income tax. Puerto Rico doesn't pay federal income tax.
Yeah.
Guam, American Samoa, the other.
Right,
the other
right. Groups. Senator, is there any funding that you do not receive for D.C. area residents that states get allocations for?
Well, sure, there is. I mean, specifically, I can't tell you what they are off the top of my head. We certainly get Medicaid funding and all the kind of standard funding that most states get. But, you know, part of the job of a United States senator is to lobby for funding for his state. And some senators were really great at it. Bobby Byrd, senator from West Virginia, got more for the people of West Virginia than they ever paid in federal taxes.
Yeah.
So without two lobbyists in the United States Senate to actually accomplish this for the people of the District of Columbia, it's safe to assume that, yes, there's money out there that should be coming to district residents that doesn't.
Yeah. Senator, let me ask you before we break for a commercial, quick commercial, statehood for Puerto Rico. How does it compare to the D.C.? Is this a question of perhaps Puerto Rico being larger and having a larger population? Does it rest with a productivity issue? Or how do you compare – because I know years ago there was Puerto Rico was a contentious issue regarding whether or not they should become the 51st state or not.
Well, it's still a contentious issue in Puerto Rico, and actually they just had – a plebiscite election in November where 61% of the population voted in favor of statehood as a form of government, and that was the first time that Puerto Ricans have ever voted in favor of statehood. So that's been the holdup for Puerto Rico over the years, is that you have to have a desire for statehood. That's the first step, and the Puerto Ricans had never demonstrated that the majority of Puerto Rico wanted statehood until recently.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's always been truncated at some point. And it's always been a situation where there's never been a clear majority, perhaps a plurality of people, right, if it has ever reached that. But yes, you're right. So your argument is that the D.C. area has perhaps a little bit more unity, more of a stronger consolidated public opinion as far as wanting.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that if the Puerto Ricans, who have been citizens of the United States since the early 1900s, if they and serve in our military, you know, have served above the national average, if they want statehood based on the vote that was taken in November, I support them 100%. And becoming a state.
You know,
so I don't think it's a contest with Puerto Rico. In fact, several people have mentioned that states come in two at a time as a rule. You know, back when states were coming in during the Civil
War. Yeah, to
balance
out congressional representation and all that. Yes, yes, that's true.
Yeah. So maybe the tact to take with Puerto Rico is to team up with Puerto Rico and work together to become a state. And there are officials in the District of Columbia as well as in Puerto Rico that are looking into this.
What do you think is going to happen first, coming in as a state, Puerto Rico or the D.C. area?
Well, you know, I've got to be a cheerleader for the home team. I think it's going to be the District of Columbia. You know, we're working hard, and we really want it, and we've got a constitution. We've had a constitutional convention. We put together a constitution. We have everything in line for statehood, and now we have two bills currently in Congress, one in the United States Senate with four co-sponsors and one in the House of Representatives with 20 co-sponsors, the first time we've had statehood legislation in the United States Congress since 1993. So we're ready to move anytime.
Senator,
all we need is a majority vote of Congress.
You know, as a teacher myself, I'm curious to know a little bit more about something that you have or have been working on for a while now, Teach Democracy DC, which is something interesting that I'd like to give you a chance to explain further to our audience. But first, let me take a quick break at this time.
Okay.
And we'll be right back with Mr. Michael Brown, U.S. Senator for the District of Columbia. Okay, let's take a quick pause here for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments. My number is toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also mention a quick word about the Valley of Avcom. Airline companies, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at Avcom really do go out of their way to make sure all your destinations are met. What do these folks do? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order, and we know how important that can really be. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why do airlines pay attention to Avcom? Well, Avcom is one of the largest third-party automatic test equipment operators in Miami. We provide avionics and component repairs, defect rectifications, schedule maintenance, and overhaul modifications of avionics. They are also an FAA, EASA, and pending CAAC-approved repair facility that have been in business for over 25 years. They are an approved repair station for GMF, Air Transit, Air Wisconsin, Boeing, Calm Air, Delta, ExpressJet, Allegiant Airlines, KLM, Lufthansa, Monarch, Saab, SkyWest, used to be U.S. Airline, now American Airlines, Iceland Air, etc. Avcom operates in 17 automatic test equipment systems and is an approved vendor for 95% of domestic
and international carriers. They have a warranty rate also of less than 1%. Now, get a load of this. They are a one-stop avionics repair shop specializing in all three manufactured TCAS systems. In addition, they have a TCAS antenna repair program, a flat rate of $1,895, no evaluation fee, designed so you can evaluate the cost benefits of repairing versus replacement. They do repair all overhaul high-end avionics manufactured by Bendix, King, Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, ACSS, Smiths, Thales, and BAE in current production for Airbus, Boeing, Douglas, CRG, and ERJ aircraft. They offer a superior service and the fastest turnaround time possible. They would be very, very pleased if they would allow you a quote for the next repair. So, please call these folks at the local number in Miami, 305-436-0300. That's 305-436-0300. Or you can also check them out at the web. That's www.avcom-avionics.com. That's www.avcom-avionics.com.
Friday night, I'm going nowhere. All the lights are changing green to red. Turning over TV stations, situations running through my head.
Okay, we are back. Senator, can you elaborate a little bit more on something that may concern me as a teacher? Teach Democracy DC. What is it?
Well, Teach Democracy DC grew out of the fact that I was asked to present in front of the National Conference of Social Studies teachers the idea of DC statehood and what they could do to help in the process. And when we did this research on exactly how to put together a presentation for this clinic that we did at their national conference, we started to realize that the history of the District of Columbia really is the history of America, and that there were many lessons that could be learned in the struggle for the District of Columbia's equal rights. So we took what the Center for Civic Education, which is a nonpartisan group that puts together social studies standards, had for high school standards, and we connected our struggle for the District of Columbia to those standards. We did some research. We put out some material. We've created a website. And actually, we had a history class of high school students from Missouri go to the state capitol and demand a resolution in support of giving a vote to the District of Columbia. The students from this high school did that, and they made posters and T-shirts. And our opinion is, if you get your kids involved in this struggle, they'll learn a lot about the
political system. That's terrific. That's great, because, you know, I'm as a teacher in the local school that I work at, I'm department head of the history department there. And we can do an awful lot of things in that avenue as well. That's great. That's terrific.
And especially getting people. Story that involves Frederick Douglass and Lyndon Johnson and you know, I mean, Mrs. Eisenhower and, you know, there's a lot of history in this.
Sure. And getting people involved across various states, I think that's terrific. How is this connected to Horizon Communications, which is another organization that apparently you're working on?
Well, actually, Horizon Communications doesn't exist anymore. It was for 25 years I ran it as a political consulting firm. And I was a PR guy for politicians, basically. And that's why I decided to run for this office. I said, this is an issue screaming for a good PR guy, because we got to get the word out.
Sure.
So I ended Horizon Communications a few years ago. But they were a commercial kind of political ad agency. We did direct mail mostly for politicians and public interest groups.
Okay. Senator, you know, I've done some reading in your bio. I find the things you've done and the manner with which you've done them to be very, very interesting. You stated in your bio that you trained Democratic candidates in the past.
Yeah.
What does your training consist of exactly?
Well, it trains them to run for political office. And unfortunately, I'm actually doing some of it now in the District of Columbia. But unfortunately, I worked for a couple of years for a group, and this was on a volunteer basis, called Indians List. And Indians List trained Native Americans that wanted to run for public office, and we were just wildly successful. We would have these training camps where we would bring candidates in, and we would just train them on, you know, what it means to do a stump speech and how you go about getting a bulk mailing permit and how you get the word out and what polling is and, you know, all
is,
the basics.
Is there such a thing, Senator, at this point in just about trying to be vague? Because, you know, and I want to be a little pointed at this, because this is the reason why I'm asking you as to what does your training consist of, because I've seen so many politicians go out, and it connects to wanting to do the right thing, the good thing, the public good, which is the way I started this show this evening. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of politicians go up there and answer questions where they have absolutely no answer to give whatsoever. They are completely vague. And other politicians do answer the question fairly and squarely. Do politicians actually get trained in not having to answer questions?
Well, unfortunately, I think many of them are gifted at it naturally, but
yeah,
but
yeah.
That's not what we ever did. You know, our training is all about, as you started the show, with the idea that it's a great honor to serve the public. You know, politics is a really, really noble profession. Unfortunately, the nobility of it gets lost very often because it's true that power does corrupt.
It becomes a power grab, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, and what we've always tried to teach, now what we taught Native Americans when they ran for public office, they very often ran for school board and, you know, very local offices. And we tried to train them that getting involved was an important thing, because if you're not represented, we used to say to them, if you're not seated at the table, you don't get fed.
Yeah.
And actually, we found out if you're not seated at the table, very often you're on the menu. So you need to be there, and that's the kind of message that we tried to deliver, and we tried to help candidates get the tools they needed to reach out into their community. But, yeah, you know, telling the truth, that ought to be something that we all do every day anyway for every reason.
Because people need to know what's out there. Yeah, people need to know what's out there. People need to know what answers a public office as a public trust is supposed to offer people. And sometimes politicians get up there and they render answers that, you know, guy A looks over at guy B and says, "What'd he say?" Guy B says, "I don't know." Yeah, and nobody really understands the ambiguity or the language that many politicians use.
Yeah.
It's
a problem in American politics. And, you know, certainly, first of all, this is a great segue to tell you that we're going to do a show is going to be an hour a week that starts on this network on April 14th at noon, and we'll run every Sunday at noon to talk about this very issue.
Well, that's terrific, because I found in your website that you said, and I quote, "I'm finding creative ways to bring America into the struggle for equality and statehood."
Yes.
Creative
yes.
ways how, and you just stated it.
Yes. And we want, you know, I think that there's a lot of people out there that are very committed to being part of the political process, but they get discouraged because of the things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
We want to bring them back into the political process.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up as a Democrat. From the time I got out of college, I started working for the Democratic Party.
You should have been a Republican.
Well, you know what? I try to remember is that some of the people that I love most in life are Republicans. So I always say that's where I start when I deal with Republicans. I say, look, there are a lot of Republicans out there that I respect and that I love and that I honor, and I need to remember that when, you know, before I go off on my ideological you know, diatribe somewhere. But but that's the idea, is that we want to bring regular people back into the process, because it is a noble process. People get involved in it because they want to make a better world.
Senator, you stated in your website something that I think really caught my eye also. You said, and I quote, "We lose more than $2 billion every year by not being able to tax the 72% of people that work in Washington but live in other states." Yeah. That really caught my eye. How would you allocate this new tax revenue for D.C. folks?
Well, you know, there's so many things that we need to do in the District of Columbia. We have so many problems, and many of them are related to our colonial status.
What would be a top priority as to your choice of allocation? Education.
Yeah, education would be one area in which, you know, we have 51% of high school students in some high schools drop out in the District of Columbia. And that's just unbelievable to me that in the nation's capital, you would have a better chance of not finishing high school than you would of finishing high school. Yeah. So education is certainly one area. We have the highest incidence of breast cancer, highest incidence of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, the highest new AIDS cases, you know, we have the highest new number of AIDS cases in America. So healthcare would be another issue.
Wow. What you would do with $2 billion every year would be really unbelievable in relation to the issues that you're mentioning, which really leads me to ask, because, I mean, you talk about the nobility of the position. We've spoken about wanting to go get out there and do the public good and do the right thing and, you know, making our legal system work in a way that makes it easier for people like yourself to go out and do the right thing for folks in the D.C. area. But I came across something, Senator, that I really would like to see if you would care to comment on this. The Washington City paper endorsed your candidacy. And after endorsing your candidacy for the shadow senator position of D.C., it said this about the position, and I quote, "There is no particular good choice for this office, which comes with no salary, no real budget, and no actual responsibilities other than to highlight the district's lack of representation in Congress," unquote. Do you care to comment on this, on the public office that you hold?
Well, you know what? I think that the public office that I hold should have more teeth. I've got to tell you that in the past, shadow delegations, as I mentioned, there's been six of them. They've been funded. We need to be funded better. We need to use the position better than we've used it in the past.
But Senator, when it comes to where it says no actual responsibilities, we've been talking about responsibilities all along. How can the Washington City paper come up with a position that has no actual responsibilities,
right? There's the institutional type of responsibility where when you're hired for your job, it outlines what your particular tasks are supposed to be, and I think that's what City Paper is talking about.
But it said there's no actual responsibility, not institutional.
There are no actual responsibilities. There are no things that are, you know, put on a list that I'm judged by or standards that I have to meet or – no, there are no responsibilities.
Okay. And, Senator, we have a caller real quick, which I'd like to get on the line. Good evening. Welcome to History and You.
Good evening. I just wanted to compliment you, Mr. Rodriguez-Walling, for your guest tonight. I think it's been a pleasure to listen to him. And I wish more Democrats would speak like him.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. And your name?
Thank you.
Alfred.
Alfred? Alfred?
Yes.
Senator?
Yes.
I think a compliment has just been paid to the substance of your political conviction.
Well, you know, thank you, Alfred, for that comment. And I'll tell you, you know, growing up in America, there used to be a thing called being an American. And I think we've lost that to some extent, the idea that we're all in this together and that we need to make a better country out of what is already the greatest country in the world, but we need to listen to each other to do that. And I think
I think he's an example to follow in the Democratic Party.
Okay? Well, thank you.
Wow, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Alfred.
And that's where the responsibility comes in, George, this feeling that, you know, this country was founded on the principle of no taxation without representation, but yet it exists in the District of Columbia, and this is a right that needs to be wrong. And this is where the responsibility comes in.
Yeah. Senator, I want to test your historical memory on one or two events that took place in the D.C. area. But first, let me take another quick break, and we'll be right back with Mr. Michael D. Brown, U.S. Senator for the District of Columbia.
Let's take another quick pause here for our audience in case you are joining us late. If you wish to call in with questions or comments, please, the number is toll-free, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also mention a quick word about the value of AVCOM. Airline execs and airline companies, please listen up. This is to your straight interest. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and the fastest way to travel. And the folks here at AVCOM really do go out of their way to make sure that all your destinations are met. Folks, I've been there, and they have a huge facility. And they go out of their way to do whatever they can to make flying the safest experience possible. What do these folks do in particular? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are all in proper working order. If you are on a business trip or going anyplace else, you know, I don't have to tell you how important that really is. They maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. And why do these airlines pay attention to AVCOM? Well, AVCOM is one of the largest third-party automatic test equipment operators in the Miami area. AVCOM is a part of 145 FAA, EASA, and CAAC approved repair facility, and they've been in business, folks, for over 25 years. Operating in 17 automatic test equipment systems, it is widely considered as one of the largest third-party ATE operators in the entire world. AVCOM provides repairs, overhauls, modifications to nearly every high-end avionics system and associated components. They have been approved avionics repair station for many of the world's airlines and MROs, Aero Turbine, AeroSail, Air Transit, Air Wisconsin, Allegiant, Aloha Air Cargo, Boeing, Capital Cargo, Calm Air, Delta, just to name a few. And it goes on and on. ExpressJet, GECAS, Iceland Air, ILFC, Kelstrom, KLM, Lufthansa, Saab, and it goes on, folks. Why use AVCOM? They offer superior customer service and the fastest turnaround time possible. With an industry-leading overall average TAT, 9 calendar days, and a warranty rate of less than 1%. That's what I said, less than 1%. There's a 24-hour AOG support telephone at 305-436-0300 with current tag exchanges ready to go. This is a one-stop avionics shop. We repair current production avionics manufactured by ACSS, BAE, Bendix King, Honeywell, Rockwell Collins, Smiths, and Thales for aircraft manufactured by Airbus, Boeing, Bombardier, Douglas Embraer, and Gulfstream. They have a licensing agreement with avionics equipment manufactured, including Honeywell, Rockwell Collins, ACSS, Smiths, and Thales. They specialize in repairs to all three manufactured TCAS systems. AFCOM has a TCAS antenna repair program with a flat rate of $18.95 and a low $75 evaluation fee designed so that you can evaluate the costs, benefits of repairing versus replacement. They custom tailor schedule maintenance programs and technician training for any, that's any size operation. So please do call these folks at 305-436-0300. Call them at 305-436-0300. Or please, you can check them out at the web at www.avcom-avionics.com. That's www.avcom-avionics.com.
Okay, and we are back with Senator Michael D. Brown of the D.C. area. Senator, a bit of history. What was the rationale behind the Organic Act back in 1801? Can you remember that?
Well, you know, it's a little before my time, George, but there's different speculation on it. It was the Organic Act was passed during a lame session of Congress when the Federalists had control, just before Jefferson took the presidency. So there's some speculation that the Federalists wanted a strong centralized government, and that they decided to do this. But the conventional wisdom is that when the Capitol was in Philadelphia, there was a riot that was perpetrated by veterans from the Revolutionary War who hadn't been paid, and they surrounded Congress at Carpenter's Hall. And when the Congress called to the governor to call out the state militia, he refused to do it because he wouldn't call out the army on his own citizens, especially veterans. So when they came to Washington, when they decided to establish Washington, Madison said in the Federalist Papers, I think it was Federalist 24, that they needed to have complete control over the jurisdiction that they inhabited, or they wouldn't be able to have the control they needed to run the federal government.
Wow.
And that's really where it came from.
Yeah. And you know, with the whole idea of wanting to get D.C. the kind of representation, the situation came so close in 1993 with the New Columbia Admission Act. What happened there, Senator, with the New Columbia Admission Act?
Well, it just didn't. It just didn't pass. It went down 277 to 153, mostly along partisan party lines. There had been an earlier attempt at a constitutional amendment in 1978, which hadn't passed. So the D.C. committee actually reported out a statehood bill in 1993. But we just couldn't get the support to pass.
You know, it goes back to what I was saying earlier in the show about the D.C. folks just being denied. You know, you told me something over the commercial break, Senator, that I really found offensive. Would you please repeat what you told me regarding the National Memorial in the D.C. area? Because I consider that to be offensive. Please share that with our audience.
Well, we considered it to be offensive, too. There's a World War One memorial that sits on the Mall adjacent to the Lincoln Memorial, and it was paid for by students in the District of Columbia who collected nickels and dimes to build the memorial. And the memorial has the names of the 499 people who died from the District of Columbia in World War One. And it was dedicated It was a big deal. The president came to the dedication. John Philip Sousa provided the music. And a couple of years ago, there was a movement to get a national World War One memorial built on the Mall. And there was a group that decided, and they were backed by several members of Congress, that they would just take our World War One memorial, refurbish it, and call it the National World War One.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Well, we didn't think that that was appropriate to the 499 people who were killed in their lives.
Senator,
so we fought it and we won.
Senator, very quickly, as a loyal Democrat, which is obviously what you are, care to comment on very quickly, because we are running out of time, on the Obama administration. We have very, very high gas prices, unemployment going through the roof, the housing market is still flat, food prices more expensive than ever, the national debt at what, 16-something trillion dollars, and by the end of the Obama years, it's predicted to be around $20 trillion. The issue of Benghazi, is Obama full of rhetoric or substance? Does he have a moral compass here? Does he have a hidden agenda, Senator?
Well, I think he has a moral compass, and I think he's proven that. But I think you're reading different newspapers than I'm reading, George, because unemployment last week was reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics to be the lowest that it's been in 5 years. Housing prices are the highest that they've been in 6 years. Okay. And last week, the stock market hit an all-time historic high. So the economy is moving in the right direction. Do we have an untenable deficit? Yes. And I think that what we're trying to work on and what the president is reaching out to do right now is to try to deal with that through the sequester. But we cannot deal with it on one side only. We cannot deal with the entire side.
I respectfully disagree, but I think this is going to have to be another spot on one of my shows. What are your plans for the future, Senator? I hope that we can collaborate once again.
Well, my first priority is to get back on your show so we can talk a little more about the president and what he's doing. But beyond that, it's to spread the word of democracy and get people to call their congressmen or call their senators or write and say that they support the statehood bill, H.R. 292, which is now in the House of Representatives, or the Senate version of the same bill.
That's what
we need to do.
I am going to hear back from you. Senator Brown, thank you so very much for spending time on the show and sharing your thoughts and convictions regarding the current status of the D.C. residents and the future it holds for statehood. Wishing you much success.
Thank you, George, and thanks for providing the venue for us to get the message out. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Senator. And now we've come to the final part of our show where I wish to leave all of you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect regarding the sign of our times. Leadership is an outgrowth that comes from a principled person who is usually appreciated publicly by the very same people that have come to embrace his new morality of their country, which in turn makes them feel good about who it is that leads them. Politicians come and go, but good leaders, as well as bad, seem to come along in the most pointed and interesting periods of time. But regardless of the issues that surround, people always like to rally behind the leader with a message, a plan, and an outcome of hope. Simplicity in a leader and sincerity in his message will carry the seeds of success, but it will ultimately rest with the public at large as to whether those once posited seeds will be enough to distinguish the good from bad choices in America's leadership in determining the continued course ahead. Clearly, Senator Brown is exemplifying this position, and I do wish him much success in the kind of leadership that he wishes to render. But America today is in a dire and confused state. because it has no leadership at the federal level of the kind necessary that pulls people together and harnesses the strength and resources of what we are as a force to rebuild our priorities. America doesn't have that today. Instead, it has a president that's hard to respect because he fragments issues and divides people with rhetoric of class warfare that incites ill will against one another. It is a man who currently occupies the Oval Office and pretends to care, but only about his own arrogance, which refuses to recognize the presidential incompetence that has given us birth to financial disaster. Good leadership is very hard to come by, and when it does, it requires a gradual brick-by-brick foundational buildup of a kind that must resist the gale winds and weathered effects of bad leadership. America is worth keeping, worth fighting for, and worth preserving, if for no other reason than to ensure for the many the promises of freedom, individuality, autonomy, and opportunity this country of ours can continue to offer under a freely elected good leadership. This is your host, George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.